Space, a podcast about weird stuff. I am Peter C. Hine.
And I'm Stephen James Buckley. And today we're joined by our very first guest. It's a historical occasion. Our very first guest on the podcast. It's Mr. Mark Burford, who makes music, excellent music, under the name Field Lines Cartographer. Now, the reason we got Mark to come on our podcast is that recently he's released an album called Dream Tides. And the subject matter of the album is something that we've covered before or looked at before in Vase, and something that's very interesting to us. So we thought, Mark's a friend of the show, we know him, let's bring him on and have a chat with him and see where it goes. So, hi Mark.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on.
It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Yeah.
A pleasure to be here. Well, I'm here, but I'm also there, if you know what I mean. I'm still here.
Somewhere in cyberspace.
That's it, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Mark, would you like to tell us about how the album Dream Tides came about?
Yeah, so it was literally, it did come to me after a dream. One of those very strange, weird, odd dreams that I've had about two previous of in my life. I had one when I was about 16, I think, and one when I was probably about 25, maybe. And you'll know, if you've ever had one, I hope that you'll know what I mean. It's you wake up and you feel somehow deeply sort of, not changed exactly, but there's like something in your brain, sort of like a shard of something that's been left there. And what happens is it's sort of the dream, the details and all the imagery of the dream started fading fairly quickly in that way that it does as you go into wakefulness. And I tried to cling on to it. And what I got left with was some of the imagery and some of just the sense, the feeling of what the dream was about. But I couldn't really explain it. I couldn't really, if somebody said to me, what was the dream about? I couldn't really express it in words, but it was one of those ones where it felt really fundamentally important in a way that I couldn't put my finger on. Like, it felt like somebody or something or myself even had tried to tell me something important, and it had stayed with me almost like, you know, like when you light a candle and the candle goes out and the candle's gone out, but there's still that funny sort of smell stays in the room for ages, even, you know, hours afterwards, like someone's had a candle on. And that's how I was for about 2 days with this thing. I just couldn't, it was lodged somewhere. And I kept thinking about it. And then I thought, the only way I can really express this, and why not? Because, you know, it's a good thing to do, is I'm going to express it through some music. And I went on quite a sort of intensive sort of recording process then, where I was sort of got it out my system. I wasn't really happy, and I just kept recording and recording and recording based on the things that I could remember from the start of the dream to when I woke up. So it's an album that almost, it does go in order of the dream, whatever the hell the dream was about. But that's, it's as I recall it in my mind is what I then tried to capture, each sort of bit that I could remember as, you know, electronic music, which is probably a sort of foolhardy and pointless thing to do, arguably speaking, but
absolutely,
you know, nonetheless, it's what I felt like I wanted to do, and I was very pleased with it. And it also seemed to, I won't go on too much now because we'll probably get into this, but it seems like it wanted to come out very, very, very quickly.
Okay.
In fact, in a lot of ways, it was the single easiest thing I've ever recorded, but we'll talk about that separately, I'm sure. But that's it. Yeah, this thing came to me in a dream. I couldn't really put my finger on it, but I felt like I had to express it somehow.
That's an interesting story, really, and it's something which I think comes from a well-known historical tradition of people receiving messages, if you like. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that you're going to go and start a religion, but it's a similar, I'm joking there, but it's a similar principle to the idea of people receiving something from somewhere, mm-hmm. and that being mm-hmm. transformed into a piece of art or a religion or a message. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's countless instances even up to the present day, isn't there? I mean, James Watson invented, or he sort of helped with the discovery of the structure of DNA. He saw a spiral staircase in his dreams. Paul McCartney writing Yesterday, he just woke up from a dream and wrote it.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Did you hear Bohemian Rhapsody?
Oh, that was also, Freddie Mercury had a piano behind his bed and he woke up from a dream and crossed his arms over his head to play the piano backwards, and that's why
showboating even first thing in the morning.
Yeah, and that's why when he played that song live, his hands were always crossed over because he learned to play it. He wrote it upside down almost.
Right, wow, so, that's crazy.
Sorry,
that's
just
very interesting.
I've kind of gone off topic there.
Did you actually hear any of the music in your dream, or was it more a sense of, that's the feeling?
That's the thing. There was no. In fact, there was very little audio input at all. It was hyper visual, so everything was, I mean, this you get a little bit of sense of this from the titles if somebody listeners do go and pick the record up or have a look. It was geometric shapes and hyper sort of bright high contrast colors in a way that was obviously very not natural, in a way that was very, the closest thing I can imagine, almost like being in a video game, but then the feeling, the sense of it was so strong though. So it was like most of my other senses had sort of been shut down. The two I'd got were vision and just a sense of feeling. You know how in dreams, because this wasn't a scary dream, although there were bits of it that were a little bit, I quite often get that thing, you know, where you feel like there's something you can't see out of the corner of your eye, and even as you turn to look at it, you can never get it. It's always in the periphery.
We were literally just discussing that about dreams on Saturday.
Yeah, it was like that. So, and that always gives you a bit of an ominous feeling, doesn't it? Because you can't pull everything into focus. And it was very much like there was things there or something there with me. And so there was no audio really. No, nobody spoke to me. I didn't hear anything. I just saw this stuff and I felt a really strange sensation. A really unusual feeling of the otherworldly. And the thing that I remember most vividly about it is that it felt both utterly weird and strange, but oddly familiar all at the same time. Like, I don't know what the hell this place is or where I am, but I've been here before, or it's calling me here before, and it wants me. It's trying to tell me. That's what I think it was. It felt like it's trying to tell me something. But yeah, and to answer your question, no, it didn't inform me musically at all. That just sort of then came.
It's interesting because when I listen to the album itself, and I'm not as much a synth head as you guys are, so I don't have the sort of vocabulary to describe the music in the way that you guys do, but I felt like a really strong sense of place in the music, and there's a really strong sense of the numinous, you know, like there's something awesome somewhere around there, and it's just this grand slow, and it hints at things, you know, almost physical things, almost emotional things or spiritual things that are beyond the grasp of everyday language or even everyday music, you know, because it reminds me of something. As I was listening to it, I was thinking it reminds me of something, but the more I listened, the more I was convinced that what it was reminding me of wasn't other music. It was something else, you know, perhaps a dream that I've had, or perhaps something that I've seen or experienced in the past. And I felt that very, very strongly as I listened to it. And I found that really, really enjoyable.
That's really interesting, actually, you should say that, because I've never really discussed that element of it with anybody else. I mean, for most people, it's just an album. It's another one of my synthy, floaty, slightly odd, you know, very long-winded, very self-indulgent albums. But that is, I'm glad that's come across, because that's exactly what I was feeling. And you know, that sense that you were going on about before, Stephen, it's like it's one of these ones, it sort of wrote itself. When I actually started, I would, you know the process, I would patch a few things up, and then I would come out of this little sort of trance world 2-3 hours later, and it was done. And I listen back to it now, and there's the bits of it I'm thinking, I've no idea how I did that. I don't know what it was. You know, I can hear the instruments. I know probably what I did, but it was very much, it sort of came out in that state of, I just disappeared off into a little, almost like meditating in front of my modular, you know, and there it was at the end of it. And I know that you know all about that, Stephen, because I know you do it all the time as well.
Yeah.
But it seemed like I was downloading the bits that I could remember from this dream almost directly, and I got myself in the right place and they just came directly out and ended up being recorded on my computer. And that's the only way I can really explain it, including the titles and everything. They were just, oh, that's this one, done.
Just pure intuition. It's interesting because the imagery in it that you mentioned is very similar. I don't speak from personal experience, but it's very similar to the imagery that people get when they have a DMT trip.
Really?
So it's all geometric shapes, bright colours, and also sometimes near-death experiences as well.
Right.
The two are apparently...
that's interesting. Right.
One thing that struck me about it was I felt, and again, you know, I'm not as well versed in synth as you guys, but I felt there was an actual, like, I felt there was a refreshing lack of musical cliched cues in there, you know, which was really good because it didn't prescribe in a straightforward way what to feel whilst listening to that music. And that allowed for a kind of blend of emotions and listening to it. And obviously there's a repetitive element to it, as well as this sort of, it's almost like an emotional ambivalence to it, which I found really meditative. You know, I could really get into it. And I felt, you know, if I rewound a track and listened to it again, I felt something different the next time I listened to it.
Yeah, I'd say you've got it absolutely. That's exactly how I feel about it. I mean, I always try and, I'm generally coming from that sort of angle anyway. So that's possibly, you know, it's not like that's unique to this particular recording, but normally I have an idea about something, think about it for a long time, think what might sort of, how it might work, how musically you might explore it, and then start the process of doing it. Whereas this one, it was literally like, I woke up with it that day, it was rattling around in there for a few days, and then it all just like splurged out, all just like by itself. That's the only way I can explain it, really. It almost just like, it just came out by itself. Like I was just in the middle. I was just the thing that put the patch cords in and set the levels and then played things. And it's the weirdest thing. But
like a conduit.
Yeah, exactly like that. Exactly like that. To, like I say, to almost an extent that I can't actually even really remember doing it, if you know what I mean. I can't remember the physical act of doing it. I know where I was, where I must have been, and roughly what time of the, obviously when it was, and sort of, I know I was typically did it on either, sort of, I had to apologize for my family, which is why I gave them a couple of credits on the album, because I did just disappear off for about, whatever it was, 5-6 weekends in a row, and I just worked Saturday afternoon, most of Sunday, because until this thing was done, because it just seemed that I had to do that, and they were brilliant and didn't come and hassle me and nag me and say, you know, you're being a dick, there's other things to do apart from messing about with synthesizers, you know.
No.
They were very, very good, and it let me get it out of my system. But I've not had that sort of a feeling before with anything else I've ever done. I've always been, you know, we'll work on this, it's quite nice, blah blah blah, but this one, it felt like I was in compelled to do it, and to do it as quickly as possible, really. Which could have been terrible, really. It's interesting that it's sort of, I think, sort of okay, you know, in the main. It's weird, that, but there you go.
It's quite interesting because I've spoken to both of you separately about the idea of music being channeled, and not just music, you know, other forms of art, where the person is clearly channeling something from somewhere, and that's always something that fascinates me because, again, I feel like I've experienced that before on a varying extent, sometimes more than others. And I know we talked on Saturday Hein about like, say, Jimi Hendrix, who was clearly an example of a guy that was permanently channeling, like just a lightning rod, just permanently, you know, if you saw him perform, there's something kind of a bit unusual about that. And when you look at kind of, you know, other forms of art, if you think about, again, another extreme example, Philip K. Dick, and the experiences he had, and there was something going on
well,
there.
I think he went further in that the channeling everything became his whole life, didn't it? I think the bits where he wasn't channeling stuff was the sort of anomalous bit, wasn't it? Didn't he just end up like in that state the whole time pretty much?
I mean, I think Philip K. Dick's an extreme example, and Hendricks probably is too, but I mean, it's interesting to consider that all artists or creative people are perhaps on some kind of spectrum that goes from Philip K. Dick on one end to someone who's making like utterly boring, uninspired music like Noel Gallagher on the other. Sorry, Noel, if you're listening.
I think we just lost as a listener.
Yeah, he was a big fan as well, I heard. Big fan of the show.
I only mention him because I saw some of his set at Glastonbury and it was utter turd. But anyway, enough. the best bit of his set was, and I was only watching it because other people in the room wanted to watch it, the best bit of his set was at one point, so his band are called Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, and at one point the cameraman took the camera off the band and pointed it at this bird in the sky that was a high flying bird. And I thought, oh, this guy's, you know, he's having a laugh here.
Poetry.
This is good. Yeah, it was poetry. It was channeled. That was a great example of, you know, he must have felt compelled to do it. But yeah, what I'm saying is, do you think it's a possibility that there exists a continuum whereby there are some people who are channeling always, there are some people who don't channel at all, or maybe do in a very vague, faded way. And then there are other people who exist in between that, along that continuum, and have different ways of kind of getting into it. And, you know, because I mean, all of us are creative, all three of us, you know, have experienced that, I think, to varying
That's a very
degrees.
Interesting point, isn't it? Do you think it even extends to people who like in all sorts of other things, like even maybe even like sport, or, you know, to be like a brilliant, say, distance runner? Do you think, you know, people talk about going into the zone and all of that, and it being, could we be talking about the same thing? It's that thing that your brain has just gone into a different mode, a different sort. I don't know. I've never really thought about it like that before, because like you said, we all know about musicians and artists and writers. It's quite a common thing, but it occurs to me it could manifest itself sort of all over the place, couldn't it, really?
I think that sport's a really interesting one. I mean, I'm not much into sport myself, but you know when you're seeing it in someone, you know when you see videos of Muhammad Ali, or, when you hear about even how Roger Bannister, you know, in the 4-minute mile and stuff, you know, I mean, these people are definitely channeling something and perfecting something. There's this idea of devoting your life to a single pursuit, and how that can become something almost superhuman.
Yeah.
And I think that some of these people are doing that, and particularly in sport again, you know, which is something that I think with sport, there's almost like repetitive, meditative nature to a lot of either the training or the actual performance of the sport itself, which allows, I think, the mind to access
totally
maybe levels that it couldn't otherwise.
Yeah, I don't think it's any coincidence, is it, that in a lot of, particularly the sort of, in things like sort of Buddhism and Hinduism to a certain degree, you get a lot of the way to attain a sort of meditative state or a different state involves physical and breathing, and it's the body is a key bit in guiding the mind, isn't it? So I think that must certainly happen in certain sporting arenas, certainly, and perhaps once you've become very adept at doing things with your body that normal people can't do, you know, maybe it actually just starts to happen. I don't know, because I don't really do any exercise anymore. I did when I used to run a bit. I did occasionally get that thing, you know, when you suddenly think, shit, I am in this now, and you stride and everything would be perfect, and you just zip along, and you don't notice the miles just drop away. It's great when it happened. Most of the time you're just knackered, but very cool.
Buckley and I were listening to an interview with the occult writer Paul Weston, and he mentioned about bodybuilding.
All right.
Particular bodybuilders who that link, that sort of extreme in the way that they do their training and the way that their body and mind are devoted to a single aim, and how that can basically manifest as a form of magic, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, I suppose martial arts is the classic one, isn't it? Again, they're all derived from, you know, basically, sort of Eastern martial arts, are not at all dissimilar to the same practices for learning to meditate and stuff in things like traditional kung fu forms and things. It's all the same thing. So yeah, it's very interesting. I suppose we're going to have to, at some point, we're going to have to get on what the hell it actually is, aren't we?
Really? Yeah.
Because that's the key question, isn't it?
Gnosis.
Yeah, gnosis. I think so much of it links to your actual beliefs, whether they're spiritual or not. Because if you take, for an example, you know, you mentioned Philip K. Dick, and he almost was out of control. It was almost controlling him. But then if you look at someone like Austin Osman Spare, who was doing it as a form of spiritualism, you know, he would write these books, and he'd draw these pictures and so on while he was in these altered states. And for him, it was a purely spiritual experience, you know, whereas if you listen to Nick Cave talk about how he writes music, he also talks about it in, you know, almost, you know, in a way of like divinity, and how he reaches beyond life, and, you know, and he reaches upwards. He does it quite performatively. If you see him ever describe it, like, he reaches towards God, really,
right?
And that's where he finds the actual inspiration, right? You know, and all of that, I think, comes down to your beliefs, because there'll be other people who are probably attaining this state that we recognize now, and that Buckley jokingly but quite seriously as well said was gnosis, without any sort of spiritual belief. And that doesn't mean that what they're experiencing is any less miraculous than what these other people are experiencing. It's, I suppose, it's the way they're processing it and recognizing it.
Yeah. I think that's very true.
So, I wanted to throw a bit of a curveball at you here, Mark.
Okay.
So, back
curve
on the
away.
Curve away. Back on the topic of dreams. So, we've recently become aware of a writer called Eric Wargo. Have you heard of him?
I did check him out, actually, just from what you guys were saying, actually, the other week. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
I had a very brief just scout around on the internet, shall we say.
So, Wargo... For the listener, Wargo wrote a book called Time Loops. He's written two, actually. He's written one called Time Loop and one called, hang on, I'm Googling it because I don't remember the name, Precognitive Dreamwork. Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. Anyway, Wargo's shown up on a lot of podcasts that we've both listened to. He seems to be the person to interview at the moment.
Right.
And he has a really interesting theory. His idea is basically that dreams are a form of precognition, and there's a sort of retrocausality involved whereby what happens in our dreams actually sort of predicts what will happen in our lives, and it's almost like a message from our future selves,
right?
Or from someone else.
I have an example of this from actually today.
Okay.
So at the end of last year, my girlfriend's dad had a heart attack, and he's fine now, and he recovered, and he's had surgery and so on, and he's basically fine. Last night, she had a dream that he died. And then sure enough, this afternoon, she got messages from her sister saying there's something wrong with dad, and the paramedics have been called. Now, when the paramedics arrived, they actually found that it was nothing serious. But what I was trying to explain in a way that I was trying to understand it myself about this Wargo stuff is that you're not actually remembering you're not actually predicting the event itself. You're getting an echo of the memory that goes backwards or through time.
Right.
So it's the shock, I think, of when she first saw that message saying, yeah, the paramedics have been called, would be what had echoed back through time and given her that dream, which is the worst case scenario of that particular event.
Right. That's really interesting. So it's not like precognition. It's because, and it leaves the possibility of, as you've just described really well, of it not actually coming to pass. You're not predicting the future. You're predicting a feeling of a future that might have happened.
Yeah. And it's often,
that's it.
It's often associated with some kind of trauma.
Right.
So I think the one of the examples that Wargo gives is of someone who dreamt, who I think there's, I don't think there's just one, I think there's thousands of people who had dreams that related to 9/11.
Yes.
And some of them might be a bit of a stretch, but there are some who, there was an artist who, I've forgotten his name now, but he created these pieces, these sculptures, I think, of sort of planes going into two towers and things like that. And, yeah. and there was all sorts of like really crazy.
There's a big precedent for that, isn't there? There's a whole thing, particularly within air crashes. I don't know why it's particularly air crash. I think Lockerbie's another one. There's a whole, it's absolutely just listed, isn't it, of people that, last minute, I'm not getting on this plane, boat, whatever. I'm really fascinated by this approach to it, that it's not that you're seeing the future, because so much of the time it must be wrong, but your feelings are not going to be wrong, are they?
Yeah.
You know, and it's those that you've sort of projected and then got back. It's like bouncing something like a squash ball off a wall, I suppose.
I think the most famous one was actually, there was a guy called Morgan Robertson who wrote a book called The Wreck of the Titan, or Futility. And it was written before the Titanic crashed, before all that happened. And it was... It was about a fictional British ocean liner that sank after striking an iceberg. And there was loads of similarities to the Titanic. Right. And it was written before the Titanic sunk. And it's, I think Wargo mentions that it's to do with the trauma of an incident, and that there's a sort of feeling that comes along with trauma, even if this traumatic event doesn't happen to you specifically. There's a feeling right. associated with it, which is the feeling that most people, not in New York, probably experienced when 9/11 happened, even if they didn't like to admit it, which was this subtle subconscious feeling of, I'm so relieved that didn't happen to me.
Or like, oh my God, anything is possible now.
Yeah.
You know, again, like if they can do that, then they can do anything.
Yeah. And these are all quite extreme, even if we don't have words for, like a word for exactly what that feeling is, they're quite extreme feelings. And there, they seem to be the things which Wargo thinks can come back to us in dreams. And so I suppose it's interesting from the point of view of your dream, the dream which created the album, you know, because that seems to be something which is entirely free of trauma or anything. It seems to be quite a benevolent sort of thing. And, you know, maybe it's not true of all dreams. It probably isn't, you know, and it could be coming from something else. But I suppose I'm just bringing it up in terms of, it's just another facet to it, isn't it? And maybe some dreams are things which are channeled from another place, or a particular state of mind, of a state of gnosis. Some dreams are, you know, have this retrocausality going on.
I think there's definitely different. I was thinking about this a lot, and there's definitely different sorts of types of dream, aren't there? I think.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say, you know, so if you're fairly, you know, I'm fairly. I always describe myself as an open-minded skeptic. In that, so I'm, you know, the perceived sort of idea of a dream is like your brain sorts through a load of stuff and sort of maybe put things in boxes like that for the day or the week or whatever. I think there's definitely elements of that when it's that sort of a dream. We've all had them. They're really boring. Nothing particularly weird happens. It's just slightly weird. And that's it. And then you get these other ones that are just way out there. And then there's all other ones that are sort of in between. And it's, without knowing where dreams come from or what they are, we don't know if they're separate actual experiences or if they're just, you know, different sort of intensities of the same thing. Because I suppose what we've got to get into is, what the hell are dreams, you know, where do they come from, what even are they, you know? And I thought about this, and I don't know if we should go into this or not, but it dawned on me,
we probably should.
Oh, okay. Yeah. that's the correct answer. It's that you can't really have, you know, we don't know what consciousness is. So how the hell are we going to know what dreams are? Because, you know, I thought about this. They know stuff about, like, so when you go, your whole brain waves change when you're dreaming, and they're actually more active than when you're awake. for much the more you know, when you measure these things on an EEG, it's you know, you're more wakeful than when you're awake. And but you know, we can measure all of that, and we know what the different bits of the brain do. We know what your amygdala is doing. We know what, you know, your hypothalamus is doing and all of that stuff. But the best neurosurgeon in the world can tell you about synapses firing and all this stuff that we all get, but nobody can tell you how that results in consciousness. No one has actually got, as far as I'm aware, no one in the world could tell you this is what consciousness is. This is why you are who you are, and it exists here, and here it is. Nobody, no scientist in the world can tell you that. So without that, and that's just that bit of it, how the hell are we going to get to the bottom of what this is and where it's coming from? Because we don't even know what our waking consciousness is, you know, let alone this weird state where we could be any, you know, we could be anywhere else. It could be a collective consciousness. We don't know. I find it really fascinating.
It's one of those things, isn't it, where a lot of the interesting research into it has been linked with things which basically frighten old people, i.e. drugs. So I think it's one of them things where, you know, I bet there's a lot to be learned from actual money going into research with things like psychedelics and DMT and mushrooms. In a way that was, you know, that was a bit more, well, funded, basically.
Yeah. Well, I think they sort of went down these roads, didn't they, in the 60s a little bit, and 70s it became a bit more of a thing. And then I think it became very sort of frowned upon, really, after that. But it's always existed in folklore traditions and, you know, shamanic sort of traditions, hasn't it? But I mean, that's because they have a very different view from the Western view of what we're talking about. You know, if you speak to somebody from a totally different sort of cultural background about what actually constitutes the universe in the inside of your head and what happens when you close your eyes and go to sleep, they have a very, very different and often very more joined up conception of all of these things are all bound together. They're not different. They're not different things. I mean, I always thought when I was working on Dream Tides a bit, it only occurred to me afterwards when I titled it, because the title had just been there. It was always straight away, that's what it was going to be called. It made me think, oh, hang on, that's a little bit like Dream Time. And of course, the Dream Time is the Aboriginal creation myth. And their entire, they don't, as I understand it, I'm by no means not an expert on this whatsoever. I have family who were in Australia and stuff like that, so I know a little bit. You know, they don't see this hard split between what goes on inside your own brain and when you look up at the stars, and you know, it's all part of this same continuum. And I know that's a current thread that runs through lots of ancient, particularly more Eastern philosophies as well, doesn't it? It's this idea that I know certainly in things like Hinduism, it's part of, you know, we're just here in this particular strand of it right now, whereas a Western sort of scientific perspective tells you, no, this is reality, this is waking reality. There was a past and there's now and there will be a future, and you're awake and you're alive and you're conscious so you can understand it all, but that's it. You know, that's where the discussion sort of, everything else is we don't know. Where some of these other ideas about the world say, well, we do know, you know, it's all there.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, it seems to be one of the big mysteries of the modern world, doesn't it? Consciousness. And it seems to be also the fly in the ointment of a lot of scientific and philosophical ways of thinking, you know, because it's the one thing that science can't fully pin down. And it seems like we've been very quick to dismiss non-traditional, non-Western forms of thinking about this stuff, which may be onto something which we're not allowing ourselves to believe in because it doesn't fit in with this very standardized, you know, scientific methodology that we're governed by at the moment. I find that quite an interesting way of like understanding the world, because when I think about, you know, you hear about these studies that try to say prove or disprove magic working or different forms of magic working scientifically or non-scientifically, and it's all based on whether those results are repeatable. You know, you got it with Uri Geller and all that kind of thing. I'm not saying that he is or isn't a charlatan, but, you know, he's just a famous example of someone where they actually found he had a very, very high hit rate of being able to do these things, didn't they?
Yeah, that's initially. So from what I read, he initially, when he first started out, did have a very high hit rate, and there was a lot of tests done in laboratory settings where he was a legitimate psychic. But as time's gone on, he's just an entertainer now.
So he's been ruined by fame, really. He's basically Robbie Williams, is what you're saying.
The Robbie Williams of spoon bending.
I suppose it's that thing, though, isn't it, where these things don't necessarily operate on the same kind of rules that our sort of consensus reality does. And so you can't tie it down to a specific time or a specific place or whatever. And you might be able to do something at one point, but then you can't always do it. But if it becomes your job, then you've got to start to fake it. And it doesn't away from what Uri Geller was able to do. I'm no fan of his, by the way. I'm just using him as an example. But it doesn't take away from it the fact that it doesn't work now. That doesn't mean it didn't work once.
No, I think the interesting thing is that the Western scientific method is literally cause and effect, isn't it? The entire thing is based on cause and effect. If you do this and you do it in this way, X number of times, this will happen. Our entire thing is based on that. And of course, the problem with that is that's sort of gone out of the window a little bit with as we've got into the quantum world, where we've realized that suddenly cause isn't effect necessarily. Yeah. And we get into a whole different world of weirdness, which is interestingly a scientific approach to, which is very similar in a lot of ways to other philosophies about the way things actually really might be.
One thing that always strikes me about that, the sort of approach, like you're saying, the cause and effect approach and the idea of getting repeatable results, is that, you know, and like you were saying about Uri Geller, you know, he had a very high hit rate to start with, and they kept asking him to do it over and over again. It ignores a lot of what I think we know about everyday life and that we don't think about. Because, say, if someone had a dream, I'll use, for example, that dream that we've mentioned before, Buckley, which is the one that you had about that giant horse puppet thing rising out of the river.
Horrible.
Now, I don't doubt for a second that you had that dream, and I don't think anyone in their right mind would if you just described that to them. Why would anyone ever question that? But then if they made you go to sleep tonight and say, right, dream that dream again, or else it didn't happen, then everyone would argue with you. Everyone would say, from a scientific approach, then did that dream ever actually happen? Did you ever really have that dream? Or are you just making it up to impress me? Of course, that's what I think about, because we're sort of ignoring the fact that there's so much of life which isn't repeatable in that way when we're doing these things.
Well, there's also the whole thing of the other thing in science that they've got into with, because I think it's interesting to think about the parallels, because like I say, I am an open-minded skeptic. I spent a lot of my life always sticking to the sort of scientific rigor of things. And it's useful in a way because it provides you with a good sort of analog when you're talking about weird stuff to sort of go between the two. And of course, in science now, they're very into the whole thing of the observer effect, which is something which only really came into anyone's mind with quantum physics.
Quantum mechanics,
Once you start looking at something, it behaves differently. And yet this is exactly what you've just described, isn't it? It's because, well, of course I'm not going to repeat it now because you're looking at it. So something else is going to happen now. It breaks down at that point, the whole scientific method.
It's kind of like what we talked about in the first episode with the chaos magic experiments as well, and how we kind of almost tried to tie it down, that first experiment we did, to a time and a place very specifically, and nothing happened because, you know, it doesn't necessarily work like that. I think another thing to bear in mind is we're also basing a lot of this kind of the sort of Western scientific ideas that are kind of almost restricting the way we see things are also based on a very much linear model of time, whereby, you know, it's A leads to B or whatever. And some of the things I've been reading about recently, in terms of like ultra-terrestrials and stuff, the idea that they can see outside of our time if they exist on a different dimension. So they might see us as a continuum rather than a sort of bag of meat that is in this place now. Mm. And in 3 hours' time, we'll be in bed. And, you know, we only see ourselves in a fixed sort of state of time, the present. But someone outside of time, if such a thing or entity exists, would be able to see us as a kind of tube almost. And if you think about that, if that kind of model is true and does exist, then that kind of puts a lot of other things into question, doesn't it? In terms of cause and effect, because if everything's on that continuum and each point along that continuum yeah. is equally important, there's no now, because it's always, you know. And I think there's probably religions that have looked into that idea as well, you know, like on Donnie Darko, the tubes coming out of the chest, you know, it's that kind of that kind of idea, isn't it? The idea of, and I suppose that does call into question the whole idea of whether you've got free will, which is very complicated, because then if time, you know, if everything is predetermined, then do we have free will? And I know that there has been relatively recent studies that have shown sort of the chemical, electrical reaction, whatever it is, I'm no scientist, as you probably gathered, that happens in your body, in your arm yeah. or in your finger before it happens in your brain, like a split second before. So the yeah. actual action happens before the decision to act. Now that opens up a massive can of worms in terms of you know, responsibility. Yes,
that study sort of showed that we're almost sort of on autopilot, aren't we? That the whole thing, from a neurological sort of point of view, is the wrong way round. It's not that I tell my arm to move like that. My arm's already moving like that, and I the feedback is the other way around, and my brain goes, "Oh, I've just moved my arm," but yeah. actually you haven't, because the timing of it is the other way around.
And I'm like, certainly going to use that to get out of jail at some point.
But I think that the whole idea of free will is an idea that's very much based in that world that we are very much tied into, of sort of three dimensions and the fourth dimension of time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Whereas I think that just because we don't necessarily have free will in the way that we understand it in simplistic terms, doesn't mean that as spiritual creatures we have no agency. I think that it just has to alter the way that we think about how that yeah. agency expresses itself.
Yeah, I think thinking about a universe in which we literally have no agency like that is
terrifying
sort yeah. of thought, really. Yeah. You're into this whole, that's the whole sort of theory of things like we're living in a simulation type, you know, that it's that yeah. that theory, isn't it, really, that there's some puppets somewhere pulling we're the puppets and there's puppet masters pulling levers somewhere. And I'm not sure that on a, even just on an intuitive level, that really, I mean, yeah, it could be, I can't disprove it, but it intuitively feels wrong. It feels against the rest of the natural world and the cosmos as well, to me.
That's what they want you to feel. But yeah, well, it does. I think it also leads to some pretty dark places, and I don't.
What you mean in terms of human behavior? You mean if you go along that road as a sort of a, I'm not the agent of my own free will. It does.
And that kind of has some pretty dark implications. There's a really good documentary by Rodney Asher called A Glitch in the Matrix, which it's a really cool documentary, actually. It's kind of got all these people who thoroughly believe in simulation theory, but the way the film is made, it kind of, they're all avatars, so there's no actual kind of live footage. Everyone's kind of not a cartoon, but they're all kind of weirdly affected and stuff, and there's all sort of weird CGI everything, and it's all, anyway, these guys have this I say guys because they are mainly men, as are most toxic things in this world. So yeah, these people have this idea that they're living in a simulation theory, and there's this whole idea of which kind of makes me quite uncomfortable, of non-player characters. And it's the idea that there are some people in this reality that are just non-player characters. So, for instance, there's probably another 100, 200 people who live on my street. And the ones that I maybe see once a week, just out of the corner of my eye going into the house, they're just non-player characters. They're not a real person. So you two, I know you both pretty well. You're actual characters, you're real people in the world. But there's a lot of people that, if I truly believed in this theory, that would just be non-player characters. And so they don't matter. And I find that idea quite sort of, it's kind of leading a bit towards being a bit Nazi, kind of, there are some people that are more important than others, and a bit kind of devaluing human life. And and obviously with ideas like that, you end up with people that, again, the documentary that showed a young man in America who basically was so obsessed with the Matrix, and he had the black trench coat and everything, and he ended up killing his parents because he thought there'd be no consequences because he thought the Matrix was real, and that we're all living in a simulation. And I think as much as ideas like simulation theory are interesting, and I do find it fascinating, and I do love a lot of the kind of aesthetic around it, and I do like the idea of it as a kind of thought experiment, and some of the thoughts that it creates and the thing. But I think taken to its conclusion, it does lead you down some really dark avenues that aren't good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that this idea of, you know, the free will and how it's caught in time is necessarily, I don't think it necessarily has to lead to the dark thoughts, because take, for example, Dream Tides. For me, that seems like a classic sort of time loop, as Wago would have it, because, you know, you've now put this time in to express this dream as music, and it's obviously had some sort of beneficial impact on your life and on the world. And so perhaps those ripples that you've caused by creating that album have traveled back, And it's this emotional response to your own music that you somehow remembered in your dream and created the dream itself. And that kind of closes the loop. But that doesn't mean that it was any less you or your creativity or your spirit that was put into that music. It was actually makes something more beautiful, where it forms this, you know, this circular.
That certainly feels like a more appealing way of looking at things, doesn't it? Let's be honest, even on that level. It also leads me onto something that I thought about, and I only thought about it the other day, which is, I don't know how everybody else feels about the connection between deja vus and dreams, but because I love deja vus, I'm absolutely obsessed with them, and I want to know what they are. And I know that they're meant to be like a crossover of an electrical signal jumps from one synapse to another where it shouldn't have done, and it confuses your brain and all that. But whatever. Nah. what the strong sense I always get is that feeling of in the dream. Quite often, when I'm about to have a big deja vu, I've gone past the sort of thinking, has this actually happened? You know, because initially you're like, oh, has this already happened to me? That's a deja vu. But I now get, hang on, is this a dream? Have I dreamt this already? And I get it really, really strongly, because the way that my brain feels, if your brain can feel like anything, I don't know, but at that moment, it's just the same as when you're having one of those sorts of dreams. It's
absolutely,
it's that otherworldly. It's like you're here, but you're not really here. You're something's gone. You're somewhere else fleetingly. And it's such, and that, of course, they're intimately bound with time and our perception of time. And I absolutely love having them because they're freaky as hell. And they're usually the most benign things as well. They're utterly sort of banal and mundane, but that feeling is just intense. It's like, oh my God, this is actually, so I've now gone from thinking this has actually happened before to, have I dreamt this before? Because it's occurred to me that's the feeling. Actually, it's not a remembrance, it's the remembrance of a dream. It might be seems stronger feeling to me anyway when I have them.
It's that sort of, like, to me it feels like a surge. It's like a sort of like a swell, almost, like it kind of almost starts in my chest and then goes up almost like a blush or something like that. And it's it's very akin to the feeling of a dream, because it's something, you know, going back to, I think that's one of the things that you got across really well in the album, is that feeling of that kind of non-specific emotion that we don't have a word for yet, which is not not happy and it's not sad and it's not excited and it's not
frightened. It's the umami, the umami of emotions, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not sweet or sour. It's sort of strangely salty, nondescript. Yeah.
It also has for me a feeling of something unresolved. I'm talking about the album, but also the deja vu, because there's always that feeling after you get the blush, like you say, what do I do with this now? What do I do with this feeling?
Yeah.
You know, it's happened and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And that's just an instance of your life where this thing has passed, this moment has passed. And I've felt that quite strongly. And almost what I was experiencing listening to it was deja vu. When I was trying to say to you that it was almost like I was remembering something, but perhaps not something I've consciously experienced. And I thought that was really well conveyed in the music.
Well, I'm glad that came up, because that you've just conveyed that very well. That's what that feeling, when I said about it feeling familiar but unfamiliar, it was like almost a constant deja vu. I couldn't quite put my finger on where I was or what was, you know, what was going on, but it felt like I knew about it already. It had already either happened to me or was going to happen to me, or, you know, that sort of weird time. It's interesting what you were saying about time, Stephen, because I often think about that. If once we stop thinking about it in a linear fashion, and if you start to think about it in a more, maybe it's flowing, I don't know, in a circular fashion or in multiple different ways all at the same time, suddenly things like this start to make a lot more sense, weirdly. If you stop thinking about getting A to B, if you start thinking about the, you know, again, go back to quantum physics and you think about the double slot theory or whatever it is, you're not going from A to B, are you? You're going through A and B all and everything else all at the same time. And they, you know, it seems to be that the universe maybe does work like that. You know, scientists are now saying that they think the universe works on that sort of a level. And things that we're discussing very much feel, again, just intuitively on a non-scientific way, that they're happening like that. You know, everything doesn't just go from A to B causally like that all the time. That's not our... If time itself your perception of it is... Well, mine isn't. It's certainly not.
It would be a horrible world, wouldn't
it? Yeah, you know, time passes like that and then it passes like that, and it totally depends on a whole range of factors. I know you're measuring it with a watch, but the perception of time, your inner clock that you have, is all over the place. It's doing its own thing completely.
And I think also sort of, I mean, going back to like the Philip K. Dick continuum, we were talking about that in terms of channeling and the idea of channeling ideas or channeling for creativity or whatever. I think that the Philip K. Dick experience also exists on a continuum with deja vu as well, in the same way. It's like deja vu is like almost a very mild Philip K. Dick kind of experience.
Yeah, he was, you know, probably having just a hell of a deja vu the entire time, wasn't he? Constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
Deja vus within deja vus.
I was just going to ask about some of the titles, you know, like three of my favorite titles were also three of my favorite tracks, which was Sable Bay with Stars, Purple Dusk Over Water, and Silver Moon of the Mind's Eye. Were they linked directly to what you can remember from the dream, or were they sort of...
They were, they're interesting. They're all, the last one is, I suppose, I perceive it as almost being the most sort of cosmically feeling one. It was the one when I was about to wake up, or I was actually becoming aware that I was waking up, and then this stuff was starting to, so it goes quite sort of, it felt sort of cosmic and important to me. And then the other two were, they're slightly, it was that slight feeling of, slightly ominous feeling of things just out of the range. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't staring at the nice weird sort of shapes on the beach and watching the, it was a sort of, it has gone a bit darker and everything was just a little bit, and I think that sort of comes across they're slightly more mysterious sounding and a little bit darker sounding. And that was the sort of the ebb and flow of the dream, really. It sort of, you know, went from being feeling quite happy and relaxed and I've been here before and wow, this is quite cool. And then slightly, this is a little bit unnerving. Why am I on my own? What is going on, sort of thing. And those two tracks were definitely much more like that. And then, the last one was very sort of felt just like it was coming to the end, and like I was sort of moving from, you know, I hate to use the L word, but it was the liminal part of the dream. It was like, yeah. Oh, hang on, I'm in bed. You know, it's when it started to, but then I had this still intense feeling of like being at the center of this thing that I'd been in, the cosmic, that's the only word I can use, cosmic, is the cosmic feeling of it. I know you get this a lot, Stephen, as well. I think you get a feeling of the big cosmic tracks that just like they're, you know, you're at the
center
of this thing.
Those are always my favourite ones that you do, the sort of, the ones that are kind of, have got that like vastness, that kind of, you've got a kind of like Vangelis on Quaaludes kind of thing going on, where it's like that sort of, you can use that if you want on a
thanks, I'll have that. That's Vangelis on Quaaludes, Stephen J. Buckley. I can see that coming on my bio from now on.
I mean, that's not a bad thing, because it's like the idea of it like being slow and stretched out as well is kind of which I think you always do really well, is it's a nice state to be in. It's sometimes a bit weird and disconcerting, but it's ultimately kind of a good feeling, and a feeling which is sort of nice to experience. And the idea that that goes on longer, you know, and I think the length of the tracks also lend themselves to that, because you can't kind of, it's not like an emotion that you can express quickly, or a feeling you can express quickly. Yeah. It's a feeling which comes through repetition and through, you know, and again, that brings us back to meditation, chanting, trance states, etc.
Yeah, totally.
My notes from that final track are like walking through a forest in another world. And that's what it reminded me of, that final closer. I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah,
it's nice. So talking of like the cosmic and the liminal, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was how the supernatural, the paranormal, or the occult inform your worldview, if they do at all. I know that you've mentioned that you're really a skeptic, or an open-minded skeptic, but do any of these things ever figure into your day-to-day life or your cosmology?
Yeah, I mean, I think I describe myself as that because I've become less skeptical and more open-minded as I've got older, certainly. And I think it's a slight reticence to want to believe all of it all of the time. But the older I get and the more and more things I see happen and have happened to me in the world, the more I think I've definitely become aware of, certainly, we were talking about the cause and effect, the A to B Western science approach to describing absolutely everything is not true. It does not work all of the time. Life experience tells you that, and you can speak to multiple people who will have experiences that will tell you that. So my point of view is just that I don't know what it is, but there's something going on out there. It isn't described by that cause and effect way of looking at the world. Our ancestors have known this for millennia and have described it as such. And sometimes the wanting to explain every single thing of it away, it dawns on me that it's more ridiculous than the thing that they're saying can't possibly exist. You know, when I'll just use one example because it's one of my absolute favourites, okay? And it's one of the most famous things and one of the things I'm most interested in, which is UFOs. To go back to your initial question, I've always loved this stuff ever since being a kid. I try and keep myself grounded so I don't just believe it all, even though I really want to, but I do want to believe it because it's fascinating, and a world in which it exists is far more interesting and richer than the one where we explain it all away. But sorry, UFOs. My favourite one is, it's a really good example of this, I think, is if you look at the Rendlesham Forest incident, One of the major debunkings of this is, very briefly, is that, well, the light that they were seeing was the Orford Ness Lighthouse a few miles away, and hence the light coming and returning. And you just think, you sound ridiculous. These are US Air Force personnel on a base that they've been on for years. These are experienced, intelligent military men. You're telling me that they don't know it's the fucking lighthouse? Are you insane?
The explanations that they're coming up with become more ridiculous than the phenomena that they're describing.
Exactly. And there's a bit of me now, as I've got older, I just thought, well, you can't just keep buying into this bullshit all the time. You've got to... The way I look at it, I have one overarching thing, is that even if 99%, okay, of all the UFO sightings, ghosts, you know, cryptid sightings, whatever you want to go down, even if 99% of them are either A, people are lying, B, they're mistaken, C, they're having some sort of mental, you know, confusion about what's going on. Even if 99% of that explains it, still this 1% is tons, it's millions of cases that's been going on for thousands of years. Now, you can't just... That is no scientific method to me. If you're just saying, well, we don't understand it, so it's all rubbish then. It's like, all these people aren't lying or mistaken. It just beggars belief. So there is something happening. There's something out there.
Yeah, definitely. Your skepticism has to work both ways, doesn't it?
Exactly.
You've got to be questioning everything. You can't question every single thing that... lot of that nature that people report, and not then question the explanations where science has tried to shoehorn into this very linear, very orthodox way of thinking. Yeah. You have to sometimes question that and say, well, perhaps, because science is only a word for the paradigm of understanding which we create now and which we can go back to because of what we've talked about, replicatable evidence and so on. I'm not in any way, I do consider like myself, I love science and so on, but it has to, it's not the be all and end all, because the science that we have now and the scientific paradigm that we have now is not the one that we're going to have in 100 years, and it's not the one we had 100 years ago. The one that we have in 100 years will be built on the one we have now, and the one we have now is built on the one that we have 100 years ago.
Very much so.
But there has to be a certain amount of flexibility and open-mindedness within that. Mm.
That's exactly right. And like I say, when you talk to real people just doing ordinary things, this stuff comes up all the time. The constant cases of, well, nobody could really explain why it happened. And, you know, my own wife has got some great stories about how, as a young nurse, her intuitive sense of a doctor would say, no, that person, Mr. Smith, is absolutely fine. And she was like, this person's really, really unwell, doctor. I'm really sorry. They're not going to make it through the night. She's right. She was right. The next day, you know, poor Mr. Smith, a goner. And the doctor, with all his training and all his knowledge as well, I don't really know why. But a young nurse, just from an intuitive, empathic sort of, had said, knew that there was a very seriously unwell person who was on their last legs, for want of a better word. And this stuff is everywhere, you know. And the more you accept the intuitive into your life, I think, a little bit as well. Certainly this is what I found. The more you can see that the world really does work like that, that if you try and shut it out completely, then you'll never see it. Once you just sort of open the door a little bit, you begin to see more and more instances of it around you. And I don't think having a hard and fast rule about the way in which we explain the universe is helpful at all, is it? You know, when you just think about it on those terms, it's ridiculous.
It's true with a lot of things, that isn't it, sort of, that and that kind of mental flexibility is helpful in life. And it seems that kind of with a lot of sort of what's considered mainstream science, they're kind of almost putting the theory before the results.
And well, I mean, I tried to do this just another personal example, just, you know, because we're just talking about general more sort of thoughts on all of this sort of thing. I had a similar thing with the ghost, which we have, which is just literally outside out my door now where I'm sat. Because I'm far more skeptical 18, 19 years ago when we bought this house than I am now. And we bought this house and we started to I started to do a lot of work on it, and he did a lot of work on it. And we became very aware that when you sat downstairs in the living room and you can see up, the stairs are open and they go up. And I'd been ripping the stairs to pieces and doing other things. And we both became aware of this thing out of the corner of your eye, constantly like this. And as soon as you look, it's gone. As soon as you... And we're like, okay, that's a bit weird. So I'm a skeptic at this point. Don't really think anything of it. And then other people, like a friend who lives across the road came. Oh, blah, blah. What was that? And we're like, what? There's something, there's a shape at the top of your stairs. Ugh, I don't really like that, you know. And more people start reporting it. The next thing, the fucking cat's sitting there, like, giving it all this, you know, in the way that animals do. And we're
cats,
like,
no.
Yeah. And so I started, right, you know, this has got to be, it's a trick of the light. It's so I start experimenting with curtains and lights and no rhyme or reason to it in that whatsoever. And then we notice the smell. And then we really know nobody smokes cigarette smell when you see the shape. And it was it was one of the bits where it really opened my eyes. I thought, I can't explain this, and I'm going to have to accept it for what somebody else would come into this world. Like our friend Rachel from across the road came and said, "You've got a ghost." We used to have one at home. My mum, she said, "You've got a ghost, talk to it." So I said, "What?" And then Nicola spoke. She rang a bell. She got one of her yoga bells and went, "Bing, bing, 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 bing. Hi, we live here now. We don't mean you any harm whatsoever. We were just doing a little bit of changing on this beautiful house. We're going to look after it for you. You haven't got anything to be worried about, you know, et cetera. Bye-bye." And apart from a few instances ever since, every now and again, you get a little, but it was sort of gone from that point.
Wow.
If anybody ever asked me if I've ever had a supernatural experience, that wasn't really one experience. It was just a lived, daily, mundane thing. We'd sit there, the TV would be on, and I'd just like this, and I'd look, and it'd be gone. And it was night after night, and then this smell of cigarettes, and now it's largely gone. So I can't explain it. I'd love someone to explain it to me, but for sake of argument, we might as well say it's a ghost.
That's fascinating, and thanks very much for sharing that.
Yeah.
It strikes me, you know, you were talking about how you were trying different ways of getting the light to pass through and that sort of thing, and it strikes me that sometimes what I think with this sort of thing, you know, when you know intuitively 100% that what you have there is some sort of spirit or something that you can't define or put into a box in that way, it strikes me that if you got a determined scientist to come, they could say, well, obviously the light's coming through this way and you can see that. And you know, perhaps there's a smell released from this piece of work that you've been doing or something like that. And to me, that wouldn't make it any less a spirit, because you've got to look at the holistic thing. You know, there's a certain amount of tiny little scientific things that are actually happening to make a whole, which is, like we've discussed with consciousness, of something which is completely separate, completely different, and completely distant from our understanding. So whilst I don't think that science is and spirits are mutually exclusive, I just don't think that science goes the full way of explaining it, you know. That's just like chaos theory, isn't it? You know, because every little tiny principle behind every bit of weather that we see can be absolutely described in minutest detail, and yet they can't predict what the weather's actually going to be like tomorrow with any degree of accuracy.
Yeah, that's a really great analogy. I'd never thought of it like that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it felt interesting, again, the word intuitively. It felt intuitively different. So to start with, I could think, well, you know, there's trees maybe in the back garden, then perhaps they're moving. So I'd put all the curtains across, and it was still happening. And it intuitively felt different. It wasn't, I'm seeing light moving out. I know what light moving out in the corner of my eye. It's like Orford Ness Lighthouse again. I know what light moving looks like. This didn't look like light moving. It looked like something stood at the top of the stairs in the corner of your vision. And as soon as you looked, it was gone. You know, we're not... This is what I mean about over-explaining this stuff away. It gets sort of a bit infuriating after a while. That doesn't mean you're going to believe every single little you know, that I suppose that's what I'm trying to say. That's where I am. That's my position with all of this. Occam's razor and all of that. If there is a simple answer, okay, it's the simple answer. But when you do away with all of those things and you're still left with this thing, you can't keep trying to explain it away because it just comes ridiculous. Just accept it for what it is. Yeah.
And I think that you ignore that kind of thing at your peril, you know, because whatever it is, the way that you're experiencing it is something important and something significant,
yeah,
you know, and something that's very much for you to experience. And I think that just to try to explain that away or to ignore it, or what some people do is when, and I've done it myself, when something doesn't fit into an easily categorizable, or yeah, when you can't fit something into a neat category, you just ignore it or you push it to one side and think, well, you know, that happened, but whatever, you know, you forget about yeah. it, you know, and I think that a lot of people are guilty of that, you know, that if something doesn't fit into a category that they see every day or that they can neatly box into something within their life, that they forget about it like they would a dream, you know, it just fades away slowly.
It's sort of like anti-confirmation bias, isn't it? You conveniently forget all the things that don't fit that rigid worldview.
And I think some of that actually comes from evolution, possibly, if you think about when, you know, our species is relatively young and we spent a lot more of our time being far less mentally advanced, you know, back in the day, so to speak. And when most of our brain did its work in evolving and growing, we only really needed to understand very basic things like, is that animal coming to get me, you know, is there water near here, am I hungry, am I thirsty, etc. You know, our needs were kind of very basic and our brain evolved to deal with those needs, but now we have far more complicated needs and our brains are starting to kind of, that there are things that are just not, our brains aren't like cut out to deal with because they haven't evolved, you know, the there's things outside of what our brains can handle, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And I think that pushing all this stuff away can be harmful, you know, because you're missing out on a whole part of life that you would otherwise be experiencing with this sort of intuition and by exercising that part of your mind.
I always just think that also just the world is richer for it. That's very much the conclusion I've come
absolutely.
To. In a way, even if UFOs and Bigfoot and all of that, none of it is true. The fact that it is true because it exists in the world and we're talking about it even, and books are written on it and music is made about it and it's been there forever, that's a much richer and far better and interesting world than without it being there. So even if it's some sort of human construct that isn't really real, and then if we start getting into what's really real, we've really stuffed anyway at this point.
Maybe save that for another episode.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just a much better and fuller, a more vibrant world. So why do you want to, as long as it's not being harmful, you know, obviously that's when we have problems, is when stuff gets used harmfully. I think other than that, why not just accept it in as this is a possibility? This is.
And do you think that creativity is in any way attached to that other world?
That's a really interesting question, because everyone's creative. Everyone has massive creative potential and we all express it in different ways. And so I suspect that it is an innate part of the way that the universe works, and that humans work within that world. Maybe other things do too. So, and it feels like that feeling of it, literally descending. We've talked about this before, Steve, and lots of musicians in particular, it's reams and reams written on being the sort of conduit, being the receiver that picks up the transmission from elsewhere. It feels like that. And I suppose if it feels like that, then who's to say, you know, who's to say it's not?
Intuitively, again, it does feel that
it
way.
It feels like that, yeah. And you can't deny that feeling. You create a framework, don't you? You create a space of things, and then you sort of see what happens, and you sort of invite this stuff to happen. Well, certainly, that's how I feel. I mean, I've been doing it a long time, I suppose. I've been mucking about with this stuff a long time, and sometimes it feels like, weirdly, it's when it feels like work that it doesn't work. You know, when it feels like you're forcing it, that's when it's a load of garbage. It's always the best stuff that feels like it's just come to you from
That's why I'd never want to do it for a job. Like, I wouldn't want to, someone said to me a few weeks ago, like, you know, would you consider like doing music full time? And I just said, I don't think I'd want to. Like, I like the idea of having it as something which is apart from kind of the rest of my life and just a place I can go to, you know, and I feel like I don't enjoy making music to a brief, really.
Very much so.
It has to come from, and I'm sure you're similar as well, it has to come from what I want to do, and what I want to do will change.
Very much so. The idea of it forcing it somehow or it being contrived is of no interest to me, and I don't think it makes for particularly good art in any sense, does it really? You only get that authenticity when it comes from the heart or wherever you want to call it, you know, from somewhere. So yeah, and going back to your original question, I think we might as well say it does come from somewhere, and dreams and imagination and magic and all these things very much feel like they're a part of art and, you know, music, to me anyway. It seems to be how they function.
It does. It seems like something that humans do very naturally as well. Like if you ever watch a child play, mm-hmm. then what they're doing is they're creating and recreating their world over and over again.
Yeah.
And obviously, I know there's been reams and reams and volumes written about how modern life takes you out of that world and makes you institutionalized and so on. But I don't think that makes it any less true. I think that we are taught not to dream, basically, as we go through life. You know, I mean, I can think of times when my creativity was crushed at school, mm-hmm. Or even outside of school by friends or, you know, grown-ups, you know, and it still is day after day, you know. And I do think that when we create, we tap into something that's naturally ours to start with.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that you know, when you look back in history about all of this stuff, we very much changed all of that world. You know, the whole idea of like the agrarian revolution, the industrial revolution, the Protestant work ethic and all of that, suddenly everything becomes very matriculated. It becomes very, you know, and at that point, that's when there's no coincidence that magic and older ways, the more arcane ways, people were very much, literally attacked, but marginalized, pushed away because, you know, having that sort of thinking is not helpful if you want to get somebody to work for 15 hours in a factory, you know, for a turnip or whatever it is you get, you know. But it's true that, you know, we've been on that path ever since. And as far as I'm aware, even in say Western Europe, our ancestors didn't live lives like that. They lived lives that were very in tune with nature, with the seasons, with what was going on in the stars, with what had been passed down to them generation after generation in terms of explaining the world. And their lives were very, very difficult. But this idea that, things got much, much better, the life of somebody after the agrarian revolution or certainly the industrial revolution was far poorer.
Yeah, we just work harder.
Yeah.
We don't have more leisure time. We work harder. And we have less leisure time.
And you're forced into quite an artificial mode of thinking.
Yeah, I think that the idea of this Cartesian dualism that we're forced into is a tool almost of oppression in dramatic
fucking
terms.
Fucking Tories.
But also, like you say, the factory man has no interest in letting his subjects dream, does he?
No.
You know, in letting his factory workers dream because that makes them less effective units of work.
Correct.
And I think that seeing ourselves as separate or above nature, we're not separate from nature in that way. You know, and it stops us from being able to see the more animistic things in life. You know, it stops us from being able to see the spirit in the world around us, and eventually the spirit in ourselves.
I think that's exactly it, and I think you still see that language being used now. You still see that, you know, the commodification of the human spirit or marginalizing it to such an extent that people are miserable. I mean, the Western world, unfortunately, is there's a sort of an epidemic of that right now. You know,
and all through my life, you know, I remember it from school. It's Heinz, stop daydreaming. Heinz, stop daydreaming.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do you do? You know, I mean, in the end, here I am, you're daydreaming with you guys and recording it as I go.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, Mark, how you mentioned, like, as you've got less skeptical as you've got older. And I think that's, correct me if I'm wrong, Hein, but I think that's kind of what's happened with us as well. In a way.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I think there certainly came a definite point where I questioned, you know, the parts where I felt that I was subconsciously skeptical, definitely. You know, where I was discounting things for no good reason, or where I was keeping myself separate. And also, as well, just how I think it was during the pandemic and when me and Buckley were going on long walks and that sort of thing, that I realized how separately I was viewing myself from nature and how I didn't really feel like I was part of it anymore.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Basically, what we're having is like a really wholesome midlife crisis. It's like,
that's really, really good fun.
Yeah, it is. It's like, this is, and you know, Mark, you're like a bit older than us, so you probably
I am sadly
went through this before, but like maybe you're us from the future. I don't know, but
well, but we can only hope so.
I think it's a good thing, and I think that perhaps one of the kind of aims of Vase, whether it be just the podcast or anything we want to do beyond this, is perhaps to bring more people into this and get more people seeing that this way of thinking, this way of sort of letting some of your skepticism go. And I think Hein mentioned in one of the previous episodes the idea that you've got to be a little bit Mulder and a little bit Scully.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually perhaps something that we, I know when we started out with Vase, one of the things that we said was that we want to put some good into the world, and that we've both been, you know, quite sort of exhausted by the constant terrible stuff in the news and just how awful things are going in the world. And perhaps a way out of that, or at least in your heads, a way to make things better for people is actually to start thinking more in this way, because you end up experiencing things differently and perhaps thinking about the world differently and acting, treating other people and the planet differently as a result. I've said my piece.
I think the mainstream ways of thinking go against that as well. Like we've discussed already the idea of the Industrial Revolution and the way that we're made to work, but also the mainstream religions, you know, because I was raised Catholic, and within the Catholic Church, you're born a sinner.
Yeah, yeah.
And every day you sin. And the only way out is you don't stop sinning. You just try to be sorry enough.
Yes,
that, exactly. That when you die, you go to a better place. Whereas to free yourself from that and to think, well, you know, maybe I can actually do some good. You know, maybe that this different way of thinking isn't a sin. You know, maybe that pursuing these different ways of thinking, I can leave the world actually a better place myself. You know, and that I don't have to keep being sorry and begging for forgiveness, so that when I die, things might be better. You know, but this is ingrained in us because, you know, a lot of our society and a lot of our ways of thinking that are put forward are so heavily based in that Christian world.
Very much so. Yeah, but very, very much so. It was a mode, I suppose, of describing the world, and it certainly served. Problem is, like all organized religions like that, you have to question at some point who it's actually for the benefit of and who it's ultimately serving. And I'm not doubting it for one second, and never would, people's individual faiths that mean an awful lot to them for all the sorts of reasons. They tie in neatly with all the things we've discussed, actually. But once this thing becomes an organized machine, a machine for turning out believers and creating new believers in, history shows it's always a bit of a rocky road to go down that doesn't ultimately really help anybody, I don't think.
It quashes free thinking, doesn't it? Yeah. We're seeing that happen in America right now.
God, it's terrifying.
Awful. I mean,
It's utterly terrifying.
Are there any other places, as a seasoned weirdo, that you can think of in the UK that where you think the veil might be thin, so to speak?
Oh, there's loads of places, isn't there? I mean, I think the thing is the world's great in that this stuff's everywhere, but particularly, you know, in travelable places.
Yeah, I mean,
when there's not a rail strike on, that we are very lucky in the United Kingdom that. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I mean, just from personal experiences, the ones that always do it for me massively are anything to do with stone circles, anything to do with ancient burial mounds. Yeah. And that stuff's everywhere. If you ever go to, I'm going again in a few weeks, one of my favourite places, Anglesey, it's just like full of this stuff. And if you ever get a chance to go to Brinkheadley Dee, which is just this incredible burial chamber where the sun comes up on one side and shines through and goes down the other. I'm sure if you don't get a funny feeling there, then you're basically not alive, really, because there's definitely strong and weird about it. And I wonder, you know, there's a question about this as to whether we're picking up something that, you know, you're picking up the sense of thousands of other humans have felt like that, and it's left like an imprint. Yeah, like I don't know if that's the case, thing. But yeah, but nonetheless, it doesn't really matter in a way, because it feels like that when you go there. That's a great place, and much of that island is just covered in stuff. Scotland's the same. Castlerigg Stone Circle's beautiful. If you want to go up, it's like the sun's either rising or setting up there, just in Cumbria, and just lie down there against a stone and feel the sort of earth moving under your feet. Yeah. It's weird as hell. And the other one I really like are roads and forests are the two big ones for me.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to have to use the liminal word, but I'm sure it's something to do with it. Roads are by their very nature, you know, pieces of liminality, aren't they? That's exactly what they are. So, for example, I don't know if you've ever been any length along the, I think it's called the Ridgeway in southern England, where it sort of starts off in the west, the sort of Cotswolds, and works its way further east. There's some stretches of that are incredibly, incredibly weird at the right time of day. If you just stop and get out and have a walk along, it's there's the main road over Bodmin Moor, which itself is the veil's definitely thin on Bodmin Moor. I once had an amazing day walking around there, and it helped that the mist was swirling in and everything. It was full. It was full Hound of the Baskervilles time, but
yeah,
it was beast. It was amazing. You know, it's a beautiful and amazing place. And then there's these things called the cheese rings, which are they look like giants have piled up stones on top of each other, literally flat stones. You know, 20 feet high, but it's actually a natural thing of erosion, but it's nonetheless weird as hell for it. Anything like that. I grew up, before I moved to Lancashire 30 years ago, I grew up, the Foss Way was literally at the end of where I grew up as a kid, and that's weird as hell. I mean, there's Roman armies marching up and down that at 2 o'clock in the morning and all of that sort of stuff, you know. So there's things everywhere, you know. You're like this, Stephen, because you're an Indiana Jones fan, but I it was a long time ago. You know, my good friend Mr. Andrew East, who is also originally from my neck of the woods, he apparently, one of the tablets that was in the Ark of the Covenant was actually possibly found in a well about a mile from where he grew up in some little sleepy Warwickshire village. And there's another researcher who thinks they've got evidence that the Holy Grail ended up down the road from there as well. So, you know, there's weird everywhere.
This sorts of stuff, when you get into the whole like English mythology and archaeology and stuff, you should really read some Paul Weston. It's pretty wild stuff. I've got one of his books, which I'll lend you when I've finished It's kind of linking like Aleister Crowley to like UFOs and then basically Crowley's influence over the whole of everything in the 20th century. But he's written other books about like the Grail mythos and his personal quests.
All right, well, I'll check him out, definitely.
Yeah, his I'll send you some links, but his stuff is fascinating and it really reminded me of a lot of what you were saying there to do with the ancient stuff and ancient England particularly, you know.
Oh, it's full of it. The stuff's just everywhere, literally any town or village you go to.
Yeah, and I noticed like with the ancient thing as well, that's very much a vibe that I've got from your music, not just Dream Tides, but previous albums you've done, going back to sort of the first Field Lines Cartographer album that you did a few years ago. It's a feeling of something ancient, which I think that you kind of get across. It's that same feeling that I get. And I think I've said this to you before, it's that same feeling I get when I'm in a very old place that isn't necessarily still functional, you know, like a stone circle or like a, you know, not an old church, not an old building that's still going, you know, that's still functioning, but like just the idea of like an ancient cave or there's some kind of ancient, I think ancient wonder is the term that I use. And that's a feeling that goes across all of your music.
Yeah, I love that sort of stuff. That's why I'm always thinking about that sort of thing, because we walk over it, you know, we walk over it every day. If you live in, you know, if you're living in Preston, if you're living in Lancaster, if you're living anywhere, you're walking above and around this stuff. It's literally buried beneath our feet. And I find that really, it's probably my sort of history background, you know, but I love it. I just love the idea that all that stuff's still there. We're just perched on top of it. And at some point, somebody's going to be perched on top of us, you know.
I always think that about Britain, is that we've got actually quite a small land mass, but historically, we're just stacked here, like high on top of
all this history. Amazing. And you dig down and it's all still there. It's great. I mean, who doesn't want to get carried away by that? What a beautiful thing to think about. And especially, you know, the other one I always mention is forests. Forests are just, they're just the best, aren't they, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
These massive living things that have been here, and the things that they have seen that have gone on, you know, underneath them and around them, and just the weirdness of a forest, the way you go in and all the sound changes. Do you know what I mean? That sound, because it suddenly goes all sort of, it's all diffused and dampened, and it, rather than the big outside sound, you get this little, like someone's thrown a blanket over it all, and then there's weird shadows. And I think there's no surprise why forests feature so heavily in folklore and mythology and fairy stories and everything, because they're wonderful, mystical feeling places. So I mean, yeah, in terms of this country, you just stick a pin in a map, pretty much, you know.
Yeah,
unless it's Skelmersdale.
There was one question that I wanted to ask you, which was something that we love to do. We love to recommend things, and we love to have things recommended to us, you know, music, books, TV, art, anything. Is there anything that you can recommend that's in the ilk of Vase, in the spirit of Vase, that you could recommend to us? Any films or books or music that you think would be appealing to us?
Yeah. So I mentioned it briefly before. One of my absolute things that I'm massively into is the whole Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you've never read Left at East Gate...
I have. You lent it me.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
I just think it's astonishing.
It's
brilliant. I recommend anybody to read that and then come back to me and say, no, there's nothing went on there. It's just the Orford Ness lighthouse.
Back to Orford Ness again.
Yeah, you know, I've been there. That's a liminal place. Actually, stand at East Gate. I went there with I have a friend who from university who is from Woodbridge. And we went and he said, we're going to East Gate. And he said, on 2 days after that happened, my friend, he wasn't there, he'd gone to university, I think he was older than him. He said, my friend said he stood and he watched them cut forest down and load trees into the back of Galaxy transporter planes.
Wow.
And so that's not a made-up thing. That's a proper, that was his best friend told him that. So, yeah, but that's a terrific book on that subject. I love all that stuff, but I would thoroughly recommend that. I mean... films, are always inspiring. I think we've talked about this before, Steve, and I was really bowled over by the recent film of the Green Knight. I just thought was,
oh yeah, fantastic.
Just astonishing on so many levels, really, in a way that we've been talking about dreams fundamentally, and that entire film is just one long waking dream from beginning to end. It really is.
I mean, I know Hein hasn't seen it, so I don't, but there's one scene in particular which really, really like stuck with me on a sort of emotional level. And it wasn't a specific, again, like your album, it wasn't a specific emotion. It was just a sort of feeling of awe and a feeling of like weirdly uncanny. And yeah,
the very few things that I've seen that I could work from beginning to end on that level, and that film really, really, really does. I mean, the only other things, you're almost into sort of Tarkovsky sort of territory, really. It gave me the same sort of feeling as the first time I watched Stalker or The Mirror, actually, of that, am I watching a film, or am I actually in a weird dream? I think it's a remarkable film for that.
Yeah, the crazy thing about Stalker is that I've only seen it recently, like probably within the last year or just outside of that. But I do feel like it's changed my brain a little
bit.
And that there was my life before I watched Stalker and my life after I watched Stalker. And, you know, there's some tiny switch somewhere has been flicked in my head.
Yeah, and that's it. That's the feeling. That's how I felt that morning when I woke up. It's the switch that's been flicked. And anything, be it a book or a film or, you know, a painting or anything that makes you feel like that, it's astonishing stuff, really, when you get that sense. Yeah.
And I guess your album will do that to people as well.
Well, I hope so.
It's like a passing on of the baton or a spreading of the kind of...
It definitely did it to me. Yeah. Well, you know. I felt all those things with it. So could you tell us again where we can find that, or where people who are listening can find all that stuff?
Yeah, so...
Your album and your website and so on.
So basically you can find me on Bandcamp if you just put Fields Lines Cartography into Bandcamp. But that won't be all of my stuff, because some of it is released on Castles in Space label. That's where the current album is. So go to their Bandcamp. The Castles in Space Bandcamp, and you will find all the good stuff and lots of other amazing, great stuff. Certainly Mr. Buckley's stuff, just for starters. That's just dipping.
Can't possibly comment.
Dipping your toe into it. But you'll find my stuff on there, basically.
It's castlesinspace.bandcamp.com, and we'll put a link in the show notes.
Are you on Twitter, Instagram,
Facebook,
any of that stuff?
I'm on Twitter. It's at FL Cartographer. And Instagram, I don't know. It's Field Lines Cartographer, probably. I'm lucky. It's a fairly unique combination of words, so you'll always pretty much find me, I think. But Facebook, no. I'd really rather not. Last time I gone, I sort of open Facebook occasionally, look at it, feel a bit sick, because you only have to go like look at three things, and there's some sort of weird racism or something going on. I just log straight off it. I can't abide the place.
So, before we actually say goodbye, it's been fantastic. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you. It's been really, really great.
Thanks for everything you shared with us. It was a really, really interesting discussion.
No, thank you. And you've certainly given me, I'll look forward to listening back to this again to then actually make notes of all the interesting things that have been said that I need to follow up on, because you've certainly made me think about a few things, actually, which is great, because I think that's what we were talking about. That's the sort of whole raison d'etre, isn't it, of this, ultimately, you know?
It is. It's to get people talking,
make people think.
Yeah, and definitely. It's so thank you,
and make people reevaluate reality, which is, I think,
whatever that is,
a key thing. Well, exactly. So one final question before you go. So as a fan of the weird, and as a person who makes a lot of music, what do you think, out of films and TV, has the best soundtrack? What's your favourite soundtrack?
Wow.
Films, TV?
Well, I mean, my favourite absolute all-time soundtrack ever is Blade Runner, but I mean, that's not that weird, apart from it's a good, great bit of science fiction. Although it's, you know...
Philip K. Dick.
It's Philip K. Dick, so... But other than that, in terms of the absolutely that I've watched sort of relatively recently a few times, the absolute weird, One was the other week when I went to see Alex Garland's Men, and the soundtrack to that by Baron Salisbury with this strange little vocal motif was just terrifyingly brilliant, and I absolutely loved it. But I think other than that, my all-time... Well, it's a toss-up. It's two very different things. It's either the X-Files theme by Mark Snow, which if it's just if that comes on, I'll just go into some sort of weird sort of like state. The other one is the Mandy soundtrack, which is I'd just love to see that somehow performed. You know, it could obviously never happen, sadly. See that performed live would just be like, you know, at like sort of 150 decibels. Just, oh my God.
Yeah.
That is just, it's primal. It's, I don't know what it is.
It's like Johan Johansson, isn't it? But then it's the guy from Stephen O'Malley from Sun playing guitars that are tuned down sort of
it's
three
octaves.
Unreal.
And it just goes so brilliantly with the film. You know, it just works. It's one of those ones that it's just, you can't imagine the film without it. Just sort of mind-blowing. So, yeah, and that's such a weird film. It's fucking weird as hell, isn't it?
It's Nicolas Cage. He's definitely channeling something.
You know, I thought Beyond the Black Rainbow was weird, but it's not even in the same league as Mandy weird, really. I love it. Absolutely love it. But, of course, the X-Files, I mean, you know.
Well, our listeners, I'm guessing they'll have all seen the X-Files because I think, you know,
How can you not? You know, it's...
Yeah, but hopefully our listeners will take that on advice and go out and check out these wonderful works of art. but only after they've listened to Dream Tides by Field Lines Cartographer.
Thank you, yes.
And the rest of his back catalogue and
Thank
some other
much.
Episodes of Vase as well.
Absolutely, yes. Keep vasing.
Yeah. Oh man,
always vasing forward.
Yes, absolutely, vasing forward at all times. Less vaping, more vasing.
Eyes without a vase.
Maybe eventually there won't be any vape shops. There'll all be vase shops.
We can only hope.
You've got some sort of hegemony over the entire. You know, that's a sort of Philip K. Dick.
That's what we're aiming
thing,
for,
isn't it? Yeah, some sort of weird future where you've taken a bit like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but you've. You know, it's all vase. The whole world's based around vase.
Podcast version. Well, be excellent to each other.
Absolutely.
And party on, dudes.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.